This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, to celebrate the new year, the Fresh Air critics look back at the year in television, music, film, and books. Our television critic David Biancooley brought his 10 best list and spoke with Terry last week about some of the new developments in TV that continue to change what we watch and how we watch it.
Hi, David.
Hi.
So how does this past year rate in terms of quality TV and choices in TV?
Lots of great TV. As a longtime TV critic, I'm probably the only person left who still makes a distinction about broadcast TV versus other forms. And now there are plenty of other forms. But so broadcast TV didn't impress me at all this year in terms of new programming. But overall, you add cable, you add streaming, you add all these new things. Another great year for TV.
So let's hear your top 10 list. Let's start with number 10 and dramatically work our way up to number 1.
Okay, and let me do the one preface. People are not going to hear some of their favorite shows on this. There really could be a top 20 or a top 30. It's really that good, but I've narrowed it down. So except I've had a tie for 10 just so I could get 11 in because I didn't want to leave episodes off. The Showtime comedy with Matt LeBlanc, I think that gets overlooked every year, and it makes me laugh out loud more than just about anything else that I watch. And another show that's tied for 10th, but it got lots of attention, was Inside Amy Schumer on Comedy Central.
This was her year between her movie Trainwreck and her fabulous TV series.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And her TV series has been around for a while. This was its third season, but it came out of the box this year. She did an entire spoof of 12 Angry Men, which was, you know, an old golden age live TV thing where it was a deadlocked jury dealing with a murder trial. And this time, she had a bunch of actors and shot the whole episode in black and white arguing about whether or not Amy Schumer deserved to have a TV show.
Okay, let's hear that.
Okay.
Okay. So it's got to be a 12-0 vote. Either way, that's the law. So, gentlemen, raise your hands, please, if you think that Amy Schumer is not hot enough to be on television. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. That's 11 votes for Amy Schumer not hot enough for television. Can anybody vote in the other way?
Are you kidding me?
I think she might be hot enough.
Boy, oh boy, there's always one.
Golly, that is unexpected.
Hey, and when's lunch?
So that was a clip from the Amy Schumer 12 Angry Men Inside Amy Schumer.
Yeah.
That's a great encapsulation of how she really turned her show into, on many episodes, a kind of like feminist comedy show.
Right. There was a lot going on there. And it also worked. And I don't think many people saw the original. I teach the original, so I see it twice a year. And point by point, you know, the types of evidence that they draw, the way that the different characters are drawn and react, it's a really excellent parody, but it's also making a strong, you know, political point about sexism.
And wasn't 12 Angry Men a movie, too?
It was a movie. It was a Broadway show. But it began, I will say, as a live television broadcast. That was where it started.
Okay. So Inside Amy Schumer was tied for number 10. What else is on your top 10 TV list?
Working up. Number 9 from Amazon. So this is one of the new streaming services that's getting into the business. Man in the High Castle from Frank Spotnitz. And that's taking the Philip K. Dick story from back in the 60s about what would have happened if the Nazis and the Japanese had won World War II and taken over the United States. And it's this alternative history stuff that's beautifully realized, great production values, and very creepy. I mean, for a show, once you've stopped watching it to stay with you with images for weeks and months, that's, to me, a really good show. Number 8, Louie. On FX, Louis C.K. just amazes me.
And me.
Yeah, with what he's able to do. Those really aren't TV shows so much as little mini movies. And he's one of the few TV auteurs that we have through TV history. I mean, he's basically responsible for everything. Number 7 is The Walking Dead on AMC. It's a genre show, but it's a really well-done one. Number six, which is now gone, AMC, another show, Mad Men. And I think it ended beautifully. And number five, another show we don't have anymore, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He went out very strong, not just in the last day, but in the last year. And such a smart show, and I miss that. Number four, The Good Wife on CBS. And one of the only shows from broadcast television. As a matter of fact, the only show from broadcast TV on my top 10. Number three, Justified, another show that went away. Good finale, excellent final year. And number two, Fargo, an FX show in its second season. It rebooted from the first, and I loved everything about the program. And then my number one program, which is a spinoff from Breaking Bad on AMC, Better Call Saul. I didn't expect it to be that good, but
so. You brought a clip with you from Better Call Saul. Do you want to introduce it?
Yeah, sure. This is Better Saul is a character, Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad, and he's kind of like this sleazy lawyer. And this is a prequel that shows us how the character Jimmy McGill eventually would turn into, you know, Saul Goodman. So here is a flashback where we're seeing Jimmy McGill meeting at a cafe with a couple of clients that he wants to pull in to try to make some money.
Well, I'm just fuzzy as to why you think he needs a lawyer. I mean, Craig, the way you run your office is beyond reproach.
Beyond reproach. Yeah. I'm a stickler.
He is.
You know,
he's a stickler with the money. He's definitely a stickler.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly not guilty of some.
It's certainly not. He's innocent of any wrongdoing. That's abundantly clear to me. And frankly, I don't go looking for guilty people to represent. I mean, who needs that aggravation, right? Look, all I know is what I read in the paper. And typically, when money goes missing from the county treasury, and the number here is 1.6 million.
Well, that's an accounting discrepancy.
It's a discrepancy, absolutely. But typically, when that happens, the police look at the treasurer. And since that person is, I just think a little proactivity may be in order.
Yeah, well, I just think I'd look guilty if I hired a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's getting arrested that makes people look guilty, even the innocent ones. And innocent people get arrested every day. And they find themselves in a little room with a detective who acts like he's their best friend. Talk to me, he says. Help me clear this thing up. You don't need a lawyer. Only guilty people need lawyers. And boom, hey, that's when it all goes south. That's when you want someone in your corner, someone who will fight tooth and nail. Lawyers. You know, we're like health insurance. You hope you never need it, but man, oh man, not having it? No.
A great scene from Better Call Saul, which is number one on our TV critic David Bianculli's top 10 list of the year. What are some of your favorite shows that started this year?
There were so many of them. And again, this is with the whole idea of so many places trying to get into the game and putting new things forward, that this is the first time I've offered a 10 best new list. So number 10 on the list of shows that premiered in 2015 is Mr. Robot on USA, which sort of came out of nowhere and was a very clever show. Number 9, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW, a musical. Number 8, Master of None on Netflix with Aziz Ansari. Number 7 was Humans, which was another genre pick about androids that may be more than just androids. That was on AMC and very smart. And number 6, one of the many talk show shifts this year was the nightly show with Larry Wilmore on Comedy Central. And it didn't take him long at all. I think he succeeded more quickly at establishing his own voice than anybody else who stepped into a new role. And I think sometimes even his opening moment when he would tease the show to come would get gasps from the audience because he was being so honest and so outrageous.
You brought a clip with you of Larry Wilmore's show.
This is an exact example of that. This is the very first start of the very first moment of an early show. And just listen to the audience reaction and his glee in saying it.
Tonight, Lee, we're talking Cosby. We'll answer the question, did he do it? The answer will be yes. He says he's innocent. Protesters say he's guilty. There's a statute of limitations on the charges, but there's no statute of limitations on my opinion. And I'm telling you, that did it. So let's do this.
That's from early in Larry Wilmore's first season on Comedy Central. The good news is, he is going to be the comedian at the White House Correspondents' Dinner
I'm so excited by this.
Yeah.
You think of, when Stephen Colbert did it, it was such a perfect time for him, and he handled that so beautifully. I expect Larry Wilmore is going to do the same thing and be the first one in a few years to actually really bounce out from that.
Let me just take a sidebar trip here for a moment. Okay. So the clip that we just heard from Larry Wilmore was about Cosby. And since, David, you teach a history of television class, which I'm sure has included The Cosby Show, what's it like teaching that show now?
It's creepy. And as a matter of fact, I've made some changes. When I teach one course in TV of the 60s and 70s. And so in that one, I do show a clip from I Spy. And it's very significant historically because it's the first African-American dramatic leading role. So show that. I don't teach a TV in the 80s course. So I don't have to try to get them to laugh at The Cosby Show anymore. But I struggle with this because, it's tarnished the legacy for me. I'm setting aside the guilty or innocent and just talking about all the questions. It can't be shown the same way in a classroom right now. The Cosby Show is a funny comedy, so there's got to be a way to do that. But I'm wrestling with it right now.
Yeah, good luck.
It's tricky.
Okay, let's get back to your list of the 10 best new shows of the year. You want to pick up where we left off?
Oh, sure. Now that we've built up the suspense to unbelievable degree. Okay, number 5, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, the new Dennis Leary show on FX. I thought that was very clever. Number 4, finally broadcast TV, The Grindr on Fox. I didn't expect this to be as good or as funny as it was. It's Rob Lowe as a TV actor playing a lawyer who loses his show and goes back to his home where his brother, played by Fred Savage, is a real lawyer. It's very good. It's very smart. It sounds
Very meta.
Yeah, but it is. Meta is much better. I was going to say it sounds very stupid, but yes, it sounds very meta, and it is. It's clever, very well acted. Number 3 is The Jinx, the life and deaths of Robert Durst on HBO. And then the last two we've already mentioned because they made the top 10 shows overall. Man in the High Castle on Amazon was number 2, and Better Call Saul on AMC is number 1.
I want to hear what's on your worst list. This is always fun.
Yeah, this is my favorite part.
I usually, not to brag about my sensibility, I usually don't even know the shows that are on your worst list because they're, I don't know, sometimes I've never even heard of them. What does that say? I know.
Well, it says that you trust me because I could be making these up.
But really,
I would feel better about television if I were making some of these up, especially the top one. I'll mention numbers 2 through 5 very quickly just to get them out of the way. I don't think these take a lot of time. There's Truth Be Told on NBC, which was a sitcom. Just reprehensible. I don't even want to say why I hated it so much, except that it had to do with a very young actress being given lines that were suited for much more mature people, and that was supposed to be funny, and it wasn't. So that's my second worst of the year. Third worst of the year on ABC was Wicked City, which was a, let's watch a serial killer in action kind of thing, and just very misogynistic and mean-spirited. Number 4 was Dr. Ken, an ABC comedy that wasn't funny. I mean, really was so anti-humor that it earned its place on the list. And number 5 was The Leisure Class, which was the HBO movie that was the ultimate result of this latest series of Project Greenlight. And it was just as insufferable as the director who made it. And I must say, Terry, I love doing these end-of-the-year wrap-ups. This is my favorite part, is being able to bring to you the worst of the worst, because this one is from the WE Network, and it's a show called Sex Box.
And what is it about?
Three, we'll be very kind and call them therapists or counselors or something. They're various supposedly qualified people, except no really serious qualified person would do this. But they sit there and a married couple comes out that's having some sort of problems. And they talk to them about it for a few minutes. And then they decide the way to help them is to have them just walk a few feet on stage and go into this little enclosure, a sex box, and have sex while they wait and while they time them and while the audience is sitting there. And then they come out.
That's so romantic.
I know. And then they come out full of endorphins and afterglow and get, you know, sort of debriefed by these same people and asked questions about how they did and how it felt and what's next. And it's one of the worst things, not this year, it's one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Well, you usually bring a clip of the worst TV show of the year. Do you get to hear some of Sex Box?
Yeah. You're not going to – you have to understand the Sex Box is opaque. So when they go in it, you don't see them having sex. But I hope that the creepiness – of this show comes off with whatever you hear.
Sex Box contains discussions of a frank sexual nature. Viewer discretion is advised. Tonight, three couples in crisis with nowhere else to turn.
Oh, God.
Will take part in the most radical therapy ever seen on television.
Welcome to Sex Box.
Guided by three of the nation's leading sex and relationship experts, these couples are about to bear it all.
After sex, the oxytocin's at its highest, so you're gonna feel the most open and honest.
Confessions will be made.
Brandon, did you know that?
Yeah, but it's never really been said out loud.
Secrets revealed.
She thinks I'm too far outside the sex box.
And lives changed.
I just need you there with me.
I'm not going nowhere.
All by having sex in this box. In front of a live studio audience.
Why do you stay in this relationship?
That show still on the air?
No.
Okay, so what does it say? You have a reality competition show with couples actually having sex on the show, but in an enclosed box. And that show fails. What does it say? Maybe you can't bet on the bad taste of the American public.
It's hopeful that it doesn't succeed, but it's so reprehensible to me that it exists at all.
Well, hearing the open to that with like tonight drumbeat reminded me that the cable stations, maybe especially CNN, have kind of
I can't wait for this segue.
They have these like reality show competition openings for the debates. Yes. It's like tonight, 8 Republican candidates face off.
Wow.
You know, and it's just, and then there's this like little dramatic tease for each of the candidates, and it does really sound like it's going to be a reality show where only one is left standing at the end. Do you find that a little odd though? That you know the debates for the next presidential candidate are being positioned in the opening as if they're reality show competitions.
Well, the front runner, as we're speaking, in the Republican side came to national consciousness in
true.
A reality show where this sort of a competition was exactly there.
Why am I even surprised?
It's home ground. But it is, you know, and he's in the most recent debate, not to pick on Donald Trump, but I'll pick on Donald Trump in this respect. They did split screen. So when Jeb Bush was talking, you could see Donald Trump reacting. And it reminded me, and this is going to – only older listeners are going to remember this – of when Chevy Chase on the first season of Saturday Night Live used to mouth, you know, and make fun of people as they were talking. And – it was just – he was actually doing that sort of visual humor, which is not presidential. And yet it is reality show entertainment, and the debates are getting bigger numbers than they have in decades, and I think it's because even the people presenting them, the networks presenting them, are forcing them to go the reality show mode.
So as you've already mentioned, this was quite a year for Netflix and Amazon in terms of originating new programs. How are the networks, and by networks I mean broadcast and cable, mm-hmm. reacting to what I'm sure they perceive as a threat from Netflix and Amazon?
I think that cable is doing a much better job, both in what they're scheduling and in how they're presenting it. Broadcast TV right now seems lost to me. I don't expect that to last. What they did this year, it seems to me, was to double down on trying to reach the broadest audience. You know, the whole idea of broadcasting. And I don't think that's the way to succeed. The shows that they brought out, there wasn't a really great program or even a very good program in the entire fall season batch. And I think that what they've got to do is go for very specific audiences and shows and get a few million people at a time to really like something and build that consensus. That's what cable is doing well, and it's the way streaming got on the map in the first place.
What is the economic model for Netflix and Amazon in terms of revenue from the TV shows that they're producing?
Netflix won't tell you, but I finally got something I don't know if I should say from whom, but from an actor who stars in a Netflix series who is privy to the breakdown. And, you know, he said that when his series launched, they'd worked it out in terms of the numbers, and they only needed to get like 200,000 some viewers in order to break even in terms of the investment. And they got multiple, multiple millions. So it's a different model because all that Netflix wants is for people to keep subscribing to Netflix. So if you have one show that will keep you happy, it's the same thing as the HBO Showtime model. If people don't churn, if people don't walk away, then you're making money off them every single month. And you have 10 different shows that each reach 10% of the audience, then you're not going to have any churn.
Well, David, I wish you a happy and healthy new year.
Oh, thanks. I love doing this. Thanks for having me back.
I love it, too. Thank you for reviewing the year 2015 in television for us. And I look forward to what you have to say about the shows of 2016.
Okay. I think it'll be another good TV year.
David Biancooley is Fresh Air's TV critic. He's founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching, and he teaches television and film history at Rowan University. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has prepared her Best of the Year list and says the motto for 2015 is "Size Doesn't Matter."
This year, most of the best stories I read came in smallish packages. Many books that were either big in size, like Garth Risk Hallberg's over 900-page opus, City on Fire, and Jonathan Franzen's 500-plus-page Purity, ended up being just okay. The same went for some books that generated big buzz, like Lauren Groff's Fates and Furies. Short stories and fragmented, intense memoirs dominate my best books list, along with the incredible true story of a short-haired dog. Anthony Mara followed up on his acclaimed 2013 novel, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, with this year's short story collection, The Czar of Love and Techno. The opening story, The Leopard, whose themes extend throughout this Link collection, focuses on an artist named Roman living in the Soviet Union of the 1930s. Roman has been ordered to erase the faces of dissidents from paintings. His own brother Vaska is one of those executed dissidents, and in defiance, Roman begins painting Vaska into the background of landscapes and state portraits. Roman tells us, "When I painted in a party boss, I gave him Vaska's face. I realized that before I was a correction artist, a propaganda official, a Soviet citizen, before I was even a man, I was an afterlife for the images I had destroyed." Edith Perlman is a master of the short story, as well as a downright delicious writer, so it's apt that her latest collection is called Honeydew. In the story Assisted Living, for instance, the owner of a vintage jewelry store recognizes that her shop has become a second home for a couple named Stu and Muffy. Here's how Perlman conveys the pallidness of Muffy's personality through this description of her voice. It was as if Muffy had once been almost smothered and then allowed to live only if she limited her vocabulary and breathed hardly at all. Lucia Berlin's posthumous short story collection, A Manual for Cleaning Women, is filled with other kinds of voices, voices of clerical workers, hospital staff, switchboard operators, and yes, cleaning women, who put their jagged imprint on these 43 short stories, many of them extraordinary. Speaking of jagged, Helen MacDonald's best-selling memoir, H is for Hawk, is certainly the roughest, toughest meditation on grief that I've ever read. As a response to the sudden death of her father, MacDonald immerses herself in training a goshawk, a bird of prey, which she describes as a thing of death and difficulty. Another idiosyncratic memoir about grief is poet Elizabeth Alexander's The Light of the World, which chronicles the sudden death in 2012 of her husband, a chef and painter. Alexander describes her late husband's paintings as mostly dark, but lit with brilliant corners of insistent life, which isn't a bad way to describe her own memoir. Patti Smith's M Train also touches on the sudden death of a spouse. Unlike her first memoir, the now classic Just Kids, which was all about the thrill of becoming, the more incantatory M Train is mostly about the challenge of enduring erosion. My final nominee for a standout memoir of 2015 is George Hodgman's Bettyville. Hodgman, who had a big publishing career in New York, writes of moving home to Paris, Missouri, to care for his elderly mother, Betty, who's never acknowledged that her son is gay. In the opening scene, Hodgman is roused by a fretful Betty in the middle of the night. Here she is, all 90 years of her, curlers in disarray, peeking into our guest room, where I have been mostly not sleeping. It is the last place in America with shag carpet. In it, I have discovered what I believe to be a toenail from high school. On to some terrific novels. Mary Gateskill's The Mare explores the charged relationship between a fresh air fun kid of color from Brooklyn and her white middle class sponsor. As you'd expect from Gateskill, the novel sidesteps sentimentality and goes straight for the jugular. Kazuo Ishiguro's The Buried Giant is an eerie fantasy tale about a pair of elderly medieval pilgrims fighting through the mist to hold on to their memories and each other. The story of the lost child, the fourth and last installment of Elena Ferrante's remarkable Neapolitan novels about the decades-long friendship between two working-class girls, also deserves a mention. Though, do yourself a favor and read the three earlier novels first. I promised a dog story as a bonus, and here it is. No Better Friend by Robert Weintraub is an account of World War II's only canine prisoner of war, a pointer named Judy who spent 3 years alongside her serviceman companions in a Japanese POW camp. When I originally reviewed it, I somewhat glibly called No Better Friend the canine version of Unbroken. And in this dark season, at the end of what's turned out to be a dark year, an inspiring story of steadfast courage sounds more appealing than ever.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find her list of the best books of the year on our website, freshair.npr.org. Let's continue this year in review with our film critic David Edelstein. He spoke with Terry last week and brought his top 10 list, and although Star Wars wasn't on his list, the phenomenon had to be acknowledged.
this phenomenon really renewed my respect for what George Lucas did, which was find a way of melding those old-time space fantasies with a little bit of science and a lot of sword and sorcery and some spirituality, a sensei, an Oedipal father-son conflict, special effects. And here's what's really important, the score by John Williams. Again and again, you feel the Pavlovian effect of music, the James Bond theme, the Rocky fanfare, Star Wars, how many of us went into the theater craving to hear that. And the movie, I don't know, it's a triumph of fan culture. What Lucas tried to do in his much-loathed Star Wars prequels was madly ambitious. It was like he was trying to redo Lawrence of Arabia, to show the fall of a democratic republic and the corruption of a passionate hero. But the fans wanted a beat-by-beat remake of the original, and that's what Disney, and that's what the brilliantly unoriginal J.J. Abrams have given them, and it is beating all records, and it will continue to beat all records, and people love it.
David, how old were you when the original Star Wars came out, and how did you react to it then?
I was too old. I loved the fact at the beginning that a ship went over my head. Couldn't believe it. I'd never heard anything like that in a theater before. But I was not really a sci-fi geek. I was a horror geek. I love the fact that Peter Cushing, who played Dr. Frankenstein and Van Helsing in all the Hammer horror movies with Christopher Lee, was in the movie. So I was way out of the mainstream for that one. But I wore out the John Williams soundtrack. Here's the scary thing, though. Studios have talked about franchises, and they've talked about tentpoles, which are franchises that hold up the studio. And now they're talking about universes that span multiple movies with multiple spin-offs and TV shows and books and merchandise and games. You have the Marvel universe, the DC universe. Now you're going to get the Star Wars universe. And I swear, Disney has said it wants a new Star Wars film every year for as long as people will buy tickets. And that's really scary to me.
What do you find terrifying about that?
Well, because it takes so much of a studio's resources to put. Studios don't want to make a $20 million movie anymore in the hopes of making $60 million or $70 million. They want to make a $200 million movie with the hopes of making $1 billion. So with all the studio resources monopolized by these universes and tentpoles and franchise, the gap between the indie cinema and the studio cinema has grown so vast. And I'm somebody who really loves studio movies. I love mainstream Hollywood movies. I really feel sad that the movies that get me most excited these days do not come from the studios, because in my ideal world, they would. The only way a director like David O. Russell gets the resources he does is because he works with Jennifer Lawrence. And that's the only way now that a director will get resources to make a so-called grown-up movie. And even then, it's just a fraction of the resources.
Okay. Let's hear your top 10. We anxiously await. You want to start with number 10 and dramatically work your way up to number 1?
Well, my number 10 movie came in right at the last minute and slipped in. It's Chi-Raq. It's Spike Lee's anti-gun epic. It's an adaptation of Aristophanes' Lysistrata. It's messy. It's tonally unbalanced, but it's terrific agitprop filmmaking. Number 9 is a Turkish film called Mustang. And this is a sometimes very funny, sometimes horrendously tragic story of five very boisterous Turkish sisters whose uncle turns fundamentalist and starts marrying them off. Number 8, Experimenter. This is Michael Almereyda's very playful biopic of social scientist Stanley Milgram, who devised that 1961 study in which volunteers were commanded to deliver an electrical charge to other volunteers, and heaven help us, did. Number 7, Timbuktu, the amazing Mauritanian movie about marauding jihadists who bring Sharia law to a multicultural Mali city on the edge of the Sahara. The movie is a mix of satire and melodrama and tragedy, and somehow it gels. Number 6 is Spotlight, Tom McCarthy's stunning portrait of the Boston Globe reporters who exposed a vast network of pedophile priests protected by the church. Number 5, Heart of a Dog, Laurie Anderson's lucid dream of a movie which plays like a Rod Serling adaptation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Number four is a documentary not a lot of people know called Listen to Me, Marlon, by Stephen Riley, assembled from hundreds of hours of audio tapes made by Marlon Brando, and it illuminates the genius of the greatest of all film actors and the art of acting itself. Number three is Inside Out, in which Pete Docter uses all the colors on Pixar Studios' palette to deconstruct the psyche of an adolescent girl. Number two, The Big Short, which is Adam McKay's rollicking adaptation of Michael Lewis's book about the 2008 collapse of the subprime mortgage market. Talk about a mix of tones. Finally, my number one film is Room, which is the story of a woman held captive from her teens by a sexual psychopath and the child she raises remarkably well in that space.
So when you look at the movies that came out this year, do you see any themes or patterns holding them together?
Even if you consider that there aren't enough women and non-whites in positions of power in Hollywood, we have a very inclusive mainstream American cinema now. Accommodation, assimilation. The new Rocky is African-American, but the old Rocky is his mentor. Rocky moves into the vacuum where the kid's father isn't. And race isn't an issue in the movie because on screen, for whatever reason, politics, business, both gender and racial barriers are toppling so fast. The biggest opening in film history, the main action hero, is played by a woman barely out of her teens named Daisy. And George Lucas's Star Wars universe was very male. He was very adolescent when it came to, girls. And the other new protagonist in the movie is black. Jennifer Lawrence is maybe the next biggest action hero, bringing down a Roman fascist, bread and circus, patriarchal, underclass, repressing elite in The Hunger Games. And women bring the patriarchy to their knees in Chirac. Reporters take down bad fathers of the church in Spotlight. This is a very progressive kind of mainstream cinema we're looking at.
So what were some of your favorite performances this year?
Well, Brie Larson in Room, I don't know how to praise her enough. You've seen her before. Every time you see her, it's as if you're seeing it for the first time. Saoirse Ronan is the most transparent young actress I have seen in many years. In Brooklyn, she is able to play an absolutely irreducible character. She's naive, but she's worldly. She's frightened, but she's bold. She's a mass of contradictions, and all you know is that she's alive in front of your eyes. And she takes a movie that is actually a very small movie and makes it epic. There is a film called Z for Zachariah that almost no one saw. It's a little post-apocalyptic chamber drama. Chiwetel Ejiofor gives a performance the likes of which I have not seen this year. He plays a survivor who comes and lives in a farmhouse with a young woman. This is the sort of performance that will be nominated for no awards because nobody saw the movie. It's not even that good a movie, but you're looking at a major performance by a major actor. Jennifer Jason Leigh in The Hateful Eight and doing the vocals for the new Charlie Kaufman co-directed film, animated film, Animalisa. Jennifer Jason Leigh is back. She was down and out for a little while, but she gives the most hilariously awful performance in The Hateful Eight as a woman who is psychotic and vicious and keeps getting whomped in the face, and she uses her battered, bloodied face as a kind of a badge of honor. And she brings so much soul to Animalisa. It's so wonderful to see her back. Spotlight has this amazing ensemble cast. It's really hard to pick out a lead, but Michael Keaton, somehow or other, on his kind of jittery, edgy shoulders, holds the movie together. And there's a performance by John Slattery that is very undersung and underappreciated. It's so low key. It's hard sometimes to appreciate the momentous things that are happening under the surface. Also, Billy Crudup as a lawyer in the film is absolutely hilarious. Sylvester Stallone in Creed. Look, the guy milks it, but I think he's earned it at this point. It's a funny thing when you see him now in his old age. When Rocky came out, directed by John Avildsen. Avildsen kept the camera pretty far back, so Rocky was this kind of shambling little guy in this larger city. He was a little guy buffeted by forces of nature, and he built himself up, and he went in the ring. But then when Stallone became a big star and took control of the camera, he brought it in close and down low so that he loomed large in the frames with his big muscles, and he became camp. And now that he's gotten older, directors are taking the camera back again, and he's this lovable little man, Chaplin-esque figure almost in the landscape. And we love him. We see what it was that we loved about him in the beginning before his ridiculous ego took over. It's been a year of so many wonderful movies. I could talk about Charlotte Rampling in the film 45 Years. I could talk about Cynthia Nixon in the film James White. It's, as usual, it's an embarrassment of riches. And awards, it kind of breaks my heart every year when performers are called losers who give performances of a lifetime but just don't happen to get the right number of votes on their ballots.
David, thank you so much, and I wish you happy holidays and a happy and healthy 2016.
Well, thank you, Terry. Same to you.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. This year, our rock critic Ken Tucker's 10 Best list includes 9 albums and a book. The musical genres in his list range from hip-hop to country, and all the artists have earned Ken's admiration for their songcraft. Here's Alabama Shakes with a song from Sound in Color, one of Ken's favorite albums.
The year in music 2015 organized itself around people talking, to you and me, to their lovers and to enemies, to themselves. It's the sound of Alabama Shakes' Brittany Howard belting out new R&B on Sound and Color. It's the sound of someone declaring her loneliness and deciding that loneliness isn't such a bad thing, as can be heard in the voice of the 28-year-old Australian Courtney Barnett. Her song, An Illustration of Loneliness, is from my favorite album of the year, Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit.
I'll lay you awake at 4, staring at the wall, counting all the cracks backwards in my best friend. Reminds me of a book I skim read in a surgery, all about palmistry. I wonder what's in store for me. I pretend the plaster is the skin on my palms and the cracks are representative of what is going on. I lose a breath. My love line seems entwined with death. I'm thinking of you too.
Another kind of talking is what's done by Kendrick Lamar on his hugely ambitious album To Pimp a Butterfly. Lamar wants to share his enthusiasm and serious considerations about what different forms of music mean to him: hip-hop, soul, pop, rock, and the blues. On a great song such as King Kunta, Lamar contrasts the catchiest sort of rhythm with his voice, a pleasing rasp in love with its own throaty vehemence.
I got a bone to pick. I don't want you monkey mouth f***ing sitting in my throne again. True friends, one question. Where you and I was walking, now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. Kunta, black man taking no losses.
Oh, yeah.
Where you and I was walking, now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. When you got the yams.
Other albums I admired and played a lot this year: Reckless Eric's America, a 60-something Brit's love letter to his new home country. The Mountain Goats Beat the Champ, a witty concept album built around the unlikely theme of pro wrestling. Los Lobos' fourth decade of music making to be heard on Gates of Gold. Chris Stapleton's Traveler, the rare hardcore country album that won major music awards. My favorite country album, however, was one that wasn't nearly as high profile. Ashley Monroe's beautiful series of sad songs called The Blade.
I let your love in. I have the scar. I felt the razor against my heart. I thought we were both in all the way. But you caught it by the handle. And I caught it by the blade.
I spent a lot more time listening to commercial pop radio this year and was totally hooked on hit singles by The Weeknd, Miguel, Taylor Swift, and Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars's ubiquitous Uptown Funk. And I love the underrated album called Emotion by a pure pop singer, Carly Rae Jepsen.
Be tormented by me, babe. Wonder how I do. How's the weather? Am I better? Better now that there's no you. Drink tequila for me, babe. Let it hit you cool and hot. Let your feelings be revealing that you can't forget me. Not a flower on the wall. I am growing 10 feet tall. In your head and I won't stop. Until you forget me. Get me not in your face.
Finally, a nice, thick book. Real Life Rock collects 29 years of Greil Marcus's unique Real Life Rock columns, each of which stuffs opinions about books, movies, and politics into entries about music, and vice versa. If you doubt that monthly columns assembled in bits and pieces can hold up over time, I direct you to page 141 and his remarks on a 1995 Frontline documentary about Hillary Clinton. Marcus's words read like tomorrow's news, and they definitely rock. Happy holidays to you.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies, and from all of us, Happy New Year.